Welcome to Mantle Podcast. This is Jen Story, and today I'm speaking with Nish Kukadia, who is the founder and CEO of SecretSales.com. Welcome, Nish. Can you just explain to us the Secret Sales site? It is very UK-centric, and not some of our readers may not have actually come across your business before, so you can tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So Secret Sales is a private shopping club business, and we have two sides of the business. We're a B2B business on one side and a B2C on the other. On the B2B side, we help designer and luxury brands clear large quantities of excess inventory in a very short period of time through short online sales campaigns. And we protect the brand's integrity by only serving those sales to a private registered members audience. So what the brands can do is move stock within a 4 to 5 day period online, and it doesn't affect their regular retail or independent store channels if they have those, or their distribution network. I think one of the biggest problems that luxury and brands from all different categories have had for many years is the fact that they have been reliant on clearance mechanisms and partners that devalue the brand quite extensively. So either the products are left at a discounted price for a prolonged period of time, or they end up in the wrong hands. They're sometimes seen in market stalls. You don't really know how to control how that product is reaching the end consumer if it's excess inventory. And what Secret Sales does is really take away that problem and help brands know that it's ending up directly with consumers, but also at a price that makes sense and in a creative forum that represents their brand properly. From the consumer point of view, I think really one of the core aspects of Secret Sales, the reason why Satch and I and our two co-founders started the business, was that we have this a real interest in design and sales. We've all grown up in the fashion products at great prices, and really when you see consumers and the way that they shop sales, it's much more of an emotionally led decision-making process. And so we wanted to translate that into an online way where people can visit the site every single day, find great things at great prices, and become addicted to the concept. So for customers, they can visit the site on a regular basis and get exposed to some great brands at up to 70% off, and buy them from the comfort of their homes or offices without that elbow shoving experience that you get sometimes in the big department store sales.
Yeah, so it's like a flash sale online. Like over here, and I'm sure you have that as well.
You've got Oz sale.
Yeah, but you've got the Boxing Day sales, which are just crazy when they sort of advertise that type of discount that you were saying there, the 70% off kind of prices for very well-known brands. But what you're doing is controlling it in an online environment and giving it context. And I think the interesting thing you said was it's a 4 to 5 day sale, so it really is a snap sale. It's not long-term devaluing or discounting the product. That's probably a very big appeal, I would imagine, to the brands.
Yeah, but it's a huge appeal to the brands that it's so limited, and they can also work with us to schedule the date so that they know that when their retail partners are going to be least sensitive to there being a sale for product. Because very often we're working with product that's in line with the season. So we're working with a manufacturing a tale of excess rather than the retail tale. So you know, the manufacturer of the brand produced their product. They might overproduce certain lines, so they have a portion of excess inventory left after they've just sold to their retail partners. Their retail partners will then be out there selling that product at full price with full price markups, but the brand will be willing to move any excess out quite quickly. Otherwise, they'd have to wait 3, 4, 5 months sitting on that product until the retail sells. So what we're selling is very often exactly the same as what you'll find in the shops at full price, but we'll be selling it at a discounted price within that short 4 to 5 day window. And what's really important from a consumer point of view is that it's concentrating the demand. So that it's a simple rule of scarcity. You have a finite amount of product. You have a brand that's very attractive. You have a discount and price points that are very attractive. And so the fastest customers get rewarded with the best choice. And the more you play on that scarcity side of the sale, the more you can clear for a given partner, a given brand partner in a shorter period of time. It makes you a more effective clearance platform for them.
Absolutely. How do the brands manage that well, I think a lot of brands would actually see it as a conflict, even though that you are saying you're selling the excess from the manufacturer with their retail outlets, whether it's their owned brand store or through another distributor. How do they manage that if you do have it 70% off with online with secret sales versus 100% in a high street shop? How do the brands
It's all down to the fact that it's a private member's audience. So I think one of the key points for secret sales, and we've seen some of our competitors in the UK market feel challenged by the registration process and actually remove it from their site. But by doing that, they've actually lost some premium and key suppliers. I think one of the things the suppliers want to know is that it is behind a walled garden and it isn't exposed to the open market. And it helps them sell it into their retail partners. But fundamentally, excess inventory, clearance product, is part and parcel of the manufacturing cycle for all categories. You can't get away from it. It's always existed. It's just how you dispose of it. And a four-day sale online is better than having it out in an open store for 3 months in a bargain basement environment or in a market store or being sold to job losses and not knowing exactly where that product's going to end up. So it's relatively manageable that way. I think the other way that we help our suppliers sell it into their retail partners is we have a very affluent audience that buy from secret sales. So we're really targeting AB1 females. Mm-hmm. And in terms of British pounds, they've got over £80,000 annual household income as a minimum, really. Four credit cards. They all live in detached houses. They drive quite nice cars from BMWs and Audis. So it's a very high profile audience, and it's one that the brands feel more comfortable selling discounted products to than the tail end users that might have caused the Burberry effect 5 years ago.
So the aspirationals as opposed to their actual intended target market. That's really interesting. And you can prove that data because it's a membership site. So that's really an interesting model.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you do have an incredibly enviable list of some of the most well-known brands in the world on the site that you are selling. Has there been any amazing items that have just broken, I guess, any records or your biggest selling items to date? What have those been?
You know, the biggest selling item, it's the most remarkably bizarre item that we've ever sold. Do you know what a one piece is?
In terms of a swimsuit?
It's an all-in-one, it's an all-in-one tracksuit. They're called onesie as a category, but One Piece is the original brand that produced them. And in the UK, they retail for about £150, which is relatively pricey for an all-in-one tracksuit. We sold, my brother's my business partner and co-founder in Secret Sales. He's the buying director. We made a bet with the senior management team that if we sold a certain number of units, that we would both wear onesies to our next board meeting. Mm-hmm. And it was our biggest selling product of 2012 and beat every record that we had across any of the other premium brands. I mean, other top performing brands are like UGG boots or Maurice Lacroix watches, but onesies smashed everything. And I think it was just a product that people don't like to go out to department stores to buy, but it was really well publicized in the British press, at least, because a lot of celebrities have started to wear it. Everyone from Rihanna to boy bands, parents were buying them for their children for Christmas. It was like the product of the moment at a great price, and it was the original brand that produced them. So it wasn't the imitations that you get. It was One Piece, which is the originator, and our price was better than anywhere else in the market. So it was just a lot of components that came together at the right time, and that was a really interesting sale for us. And it was off the back of things like One Piece and success of One Piece. Recognize that we're not in the business of just selling luxury brands. We're in the business of selling desirable brands, and that doesn't necessarily mean brands that are established and long term. They're just what people want right now, and there's varying degrees of that.
It's really, as that was the last product I would have thought you would have ever mentioned. I can't say there's a huge market for them in Australia. I could be way behind the times, and I could be wrong in that statement, but I can see the point that they might be something that people want to wear, but they, based on the audience you've just described that you've got, they may not necessarily want to rock out and be seen buying one of those, but they're happy to wear it at home.
Well, Well, you know what we found out is our target audience, and we, you know, we call her Kate. She wears she puts the kids to sleep.
Yep.
Pours herself a glass of red wine, gets into a One Piece, and will sit in front of the TV browsing on a tablet. And that's very much part of the cycle of her evenings. So One Piece is her thing to do with a glass of wine in the evening. It's a bit of me time. And on top of that, if her children are older, she's buying them One Pieces because the kids are actually wearing them out on the street. I know a lot of adults wouldn't wear them, but there it is a bit of a trend. So it was just a product of the moment. But then we do sell a really wide, extensive portfolio of products. And as the site's evolving, we're going to start to categorize those differently across the website itself. But we sold Maurice Lacroix watches, which are high-end Swiss watches, some of them retailing for, on our site, £3,000 to £4,000, with a retail price at above £10,000. And we have customers buying those in an impulsive way through short online sales, which is really interesting.
That is. It's very amazing. I suppose a One Piece in Australia usually refers to a swimsuit, but I guess that's just indicative of our climate. So that's very different. But the an impulse.
One Piece is the brand name. Sorry. One Piece is the brand name of the original brand that created, and a category name is onesie.
Yeah, so even onesie, then I think onesie is probably something that we probably think of as children's clothing. So that's really interesting. That is definitely an interesting cultural thing. And an impulse buy of a £4,000 or £5,000 watch is also a very, I would think, a very specialised market. So again, that's a very interesting compared to, I suppose, other competitor sites that are out there, because aspects of your model, as it being a member-based sales site, can be replicated, but you're obviously doing many things different, including having the quality of the brands that you've got. But are there other things that are you're known for, I suppose, in terms of customer experience and things like that? Is there anything that you're doing there that's just particularly special?
What from a customer experience point of view? Well, one of the things that we invested in really heavily in 2012, and we're starting to really just roll that out in 2013, is a much more targeted CRM approach. We were lucky to close an investment in February 2010, which enabled us to invest in really digging deep into our data, understanding our customer profiles, and then building the technology platform to go and target those customers more effectively, delivering content and sales information, and then right the way down to product and behavioral information within emails, on mobile, and across different platforms. So we're trying to move away from what's becoming a saturated market. In the UK, when we started Secret Sales, it was ourselves and potentially one or two others in the private shopping club business sending daily emails. Now you have the Groupons of the world, Living Social, deal-time businesses, as well as the emergence of lots of smaller players. We're seeing customers, particularly those addicted customers, their inboxes filling up with 20 or 30 emails every single day, and it's a matter of understanding how you can make your communication talk louder, more relevant to each of those individual customers than your competitors. So we've put a lot of effort into that, and we're going to start to be rolling out a very detailed dynamic content strategies over the next 2 to 3 months. So the layout of the sales, the product information, the amount of copy, the pricing, all of those different elements are going to vary. And to the point where we're going to be testing multiple templates for each of the various types of emails that we send out, either on a daily basis or the triggered formats as well, to try to help along our conversion rates.
Okay.
We also have an internal customer services team. So we manage telephone and email all in-house, and we've invested a lot in training that team to improve the quality of what they're doing. It's not a fantastic example to give you today because we've had one negative comment, but if you look at our Trustpilot review, which is trustpilot.co.uk, it's a third-party review site, and customers can comment on their experience with Secret Sales, and you can see there's been a massive improvement over the last few months. Big investment in making sure our customers understand our business model better and are able to ask us questions whenever they want. We have a comment that was flagged up today, which we're going to try to take care of within the next 24 hours. But in general, we've definitely seen a massive improvement in customer confidence with our business.
So how did you get started in this? You began in advertising, I think, and you had an idea. What tells the story behind getting started?
It actually goes back a little bit further than that. So Sach and I grew up in a household where we understood fashion. Our father was one of the founders of a jeans brand called Pepe Jeans.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 80s, we were growing up in warehouses. We knew about designers, about product life cycles. Some of the household games will spot the difference between a genuine product and a fake product. It was like understanding the details of stitching or how a label was genuine or not. And it was interesting, but I vowed I'd never go into fashion at the time. I was really obsessed with advertising. And my brother, Sach, was in buying and selling products. He used to sell to some of the big wholesale groups like TK Maxx or Costco. I ended up joining WPP, and I worked on direct response and brand campaigns, so driving traffic and then helping brands use digital medium to build their businesses. At around 2005, 2006, we had a couple of family friends, a gentleman called Michael Cody and his wife Sylvia Cody. Together they had been running a manufacturing operation for about 30 years, producing product for all the major high street retailers in the UK. So everyone from Topshop, River Island, Arcadia's, other groups, Oasis, etc. Michael's wife, Sylvia, was French, and she knew a lot about the business model, the private shopping club business model that had taken off in France but not really been seen outside of the French market at around that time. She knew that I had a bit of experience in digital, and Sach had a bit of experience in buying and selling inventory. And over a dinner, we were just talking about this business model and whether it would actually make sense in the UK. And if someone was to launch this business, this effective B2B2C clearance platform for brands that helps customers get access to discounts online on a daily basis, how would that need to be adapted for the UK audience? Because we have a much more clear environment than France or Germany or even the US when you think about it. So we took some time to explore the business model. Very top line, we all had our other jobs in 2006. And we got some research documents from France. We translated those and we understood that the business could be very effective in the UK, provided we targeted UK customers using the right marketing mix and that we only really served them brands that were relevant in the UK. And I think that was one of the major points of difference and one of the real reasons why what propelled us to start is that no one was offering UK brands to UK consumers through and attracting those UK consumers through the right marketing channels. So we started to work on a business plan and put a tiny amount of money behind a bootstrapped website, which we launched on the 18th of July 2007. And then we just grew organically off the back of that. But it was an interest in fashion across the four founders. It was seeing an opportunity that hadn't been exploited. It was seeing something work in a foreign market that could be adapted. And really, it was the fact that all four of us were obsessed with sales of great products at great prices. And I think we were all savvy shoppers. And we could recognize that in general, the market was moving towards that. We hadn't anticipated there'd be an economic downturn, but we certainly knew what Boxing Day sales in the center of London used to look like. So we saw that there was real potential for the business.
So it sounds like you had a great group of people as well, which is always a common element in most very successful startups. So what was the most fun you had getting the business started? Was it fun, or was it actually just genuinely hard work bootstrapping?
It was a lot of both. I guess we didn't expect the business to take off as much as it did. I remember going to the web design agency and saying to them, registration process, and expecting to get 30,000 members by the end of the year. So we were launching in July and we were expecting within 4 months to get 30,000 members. Mm-hmm. And they laughed us off and they said, look, we'll build it for you, but it'll take you 3 years to do it. And by the way, no one builds an e-commerce business with a registration process. That's just suicide. We got some amazing handbags from Chloe. We got some fantastic press coverage in the first month and we got 30,000 members within 4 weeks. So it just flew. It just started to fly out. And you know, over the course of the first few months, we were we were learning a lot. I think that was one of the most enjoyable things, is when you're starting a business, it's coming across problems and figuring out the solutions and being satisfied once the solution's implemented, and just having the flexibility to adapt around the needs of your customers and suppliers. It was great. It's always been great, but there have been some really, really tough times in the first few years, particularly when it came to funding. So it was tough for a small business like ours to raise the cash that we needed to really accelerate. So we had to prove ourselves through organic growth. And we did that by keeping our costs down, focusing on word of mouth marketing, getting some great brands and letting that do the talking, and punching above our weight in every respect. And we've seen competitors of ours in the UK spend a lot of cash, make a lot of mistakes, and fizzle out. And we really didn't have the luxury of finance in the early stages to do that. So kept our heads down, worked hard, enjoyed the momentum, enjoyed the people, working with the people that that were really committed to Secret Sales in the early days. And we just built the business that way. And then we started to attract external investment, because we'd grown that way rather than in a very aggressive, non-efficient way.
So did you seek out the investment, or did they come to you once you'd actually clocked this massive success?
So within 2.5 years of growing the business, so towards the end of 2009, really, we were starting to get phone calls from investors. What had happened is that they'd seen the success of the private shopping club business model in France, now that it was becoming more widely known across the continent. And they saw that we were doing it in the UK, but we really want... we were keeping our costs very much under control. They wanted to understand a bit more about our business. So a lot of these mainstream venture capitalist firms, institutional investors, were calling us to try to take a look at the business. And we found an independent banker through an advisor of the business, and started a process where we approached the market a little bit more formally, knowing that in order to accelerate the growth of the business, we really would need some external finance and some of the value add that external finance can bring as well. We managed to secure a couple of term sheets in 2009, and just before we were about to sign one of them, we got an offer from a German private shopping club that was looking to take a step into the UK market, that said they would double the amount of cash investment that we were looking to raise and give us the blueprint to scale. And so very quickly, we went from having these two term sheets from institutional investors in 2009. And at the time, our staff was around 25 people, and we were working out of a basement office in West London, in a very grotty part of town, to signing an investment agreement with this German private shopping club that had seen phenomenal success in the German market. They'd gone from zero to 25 million to 80 million in their second year. And they invested in us in the start of 2010, and we went from that 25 people in West London to around 50 people in Notting Hill in central London, and we changed the whole format of the business. But we did do that through a slightly more formal process.
So what are the biggest challenges that you're facing at the moment, or is it all upwards from here?
A lot of it's upwards from here, I think. 2011 was probably the toughest year for Secret Sales, because after we had the investment from Brands for Friends, we got two tranches of investment by them, and then they were bought by eBay, and then we had to go out to the open market and raise investment ourselves. We had to become bootstrapped again, but at a much larger enterprise size. We had to figure out how to optimize costs, optimize teams and processes, improve our margin, reduce our returns rates, and everything to make whatever cash that we had available stretch so that we could secure a much larger round of funding and go it alone, knowing that Brands for Friends had been swept up by eBay and eBay wasn't going to be the right long-term partner for us. Mm. So I think most of the hard work had been done in 2011 in adjusting the business model so that when we closed the investment in 2012, it was really just a matter of hiring the right teams, the real senior level of management, the C-level management, who could then drive the business through into 2013 and 2014. So where we are today, our biggest challenges are continuing. Well, we are, I wouldn't say that the challenges, because we've got a very clear strategy on what we need to do. We're continuing to grow at a really phenomenal rate. We've been advertising on TV since September of last year, which has really helped build consumer confidence and give us a much wider reach than we ever had before, but also help suppliers recognize that we are the leading private shopping club in the UK, that we continue to punch above our weight, but are a really grown up business now. I think that the always the challenge is how much we're able to invest in technology. So I'd say probably one of the biggest areas that I wish we had we had more freedom was the size of our tech team. And that's because we didn't invest in it early enough. We invested in it from 2012 onwards. But I wish from around 2009, 2010, I was investing in technology and using that as a really strong pillar within the business. So right now we have a team of 11 developers, 11 people in the technology team, and I wish it was double that size. But you just can't add too much resource in that team without the wheels falling off the cart. If you do it too quickly, there's a problem.
And finding good talent in technology is always an issue in most markets, I think, at the moment. They're always in demand. Yeah,
absolutely, particularly in e-commerce. I think all the really great rock star developers want to work at the next Facebook. So trying to get them to work in a business that sells products is challenging. But we're doing that quite effectively. I mean, we've got an absolutely fantastic CFO with loads of experience. He's super charismatic. And we're working with some really interesting frameworks like Symfony 2, some cutting edge stuff, which most other e-commerce sites aren't doing. So that's enabling us to hire some great talent at the moment. But it's never fast enough and the team's never big enough to handle all the demands of the rest of the business, that's for sure.
Well, that's a good sign. That definitely means that you're growing in the right direction. So what are the three things that you know now that you wish you knew back in those early days when you were living in a basement in West London?
Definitely invest in technology ahead of the curve. I think so many e-commerce businesses, and if they're sort of pure play retailers, will focus on the retail side of the business and the marketing side of the business, but they'll ignore that the technology base has so much value. And in the latter stages of your company, you'll realize that it enables you to do more and more things faster. And we're kind of paying the price for that, or have been paying the price for that in 2012, and just seeing ourselves was emerged from the other side of that in 2013. So definitely investment in technology and what I would call product management. So the architecture of your site, the usability, making sure there's a consistency in the way that you build your business. So taking on board what the consumers want, the suppliers want, but also internal stakeholders and processes, and using technology to develop a solution that's consistent across the board. So that's something that we invested in 2012, but I kind of wish I'd had it in the business since day one. Product department. Mm. The other area would be to continue to, I think, keep. Well, on that side, I probably would have had, knowing what I know now, I would have had the confidence to use more potent marketing channels. I think there's a lot of talk to always use your digital marketing mix and maximize your return on that before you start to go offline. But I think that the landscape, the consumer landscape has changed so much. Like, for example, TV advertising was the norm for major household brands 10, 15, 20 years ago. But now you can be an online retailer and you can market very effectively on TV and measure the ROI, because the moment someone sees a TV ad for an online brand that they like, they're straight on their smartphones or tablets within a matter of seconds. And you can really measure the effectiveness of a particular spot against a particular channel, against a particular time or audience. And then you can make that part of a direct response channel mix. So I wish I had the confidence to have done TV advertising earlier. I think we did it. We're still well ahead of the curve for our space, but I kind of wish I'd just done it maybe a year earlier. I think we would have grown much, much more effectively. And, sorry, go on.
No, you're right.
And the third one is I would have organized my customer data better from day one. Mm. Because now we have We have we're starting to consolidate our customer data. It's an epic journey to try to get all your touch points to feed in and build a proper data set. So retail intelligence tools are becoming really important for a business of our size. Knowing exactly what our customers are doing, what they're saying, what they're thinking, how they're behaving on the site, the stuff that they're purchasing, and using that to target them more effectively. So reducing the volume of emails that we send and making sure each of the emails that we do send are more potent. And beyond just email, the communication they get through other channels as well. I wish I'd organized my database architecture earlier in the business.
That's a very good point. A lot of people with their data, they get the basic stuff, but without having the longer term vision, which you clearly have now. That's, I guess, a situation I hear again and again. So that's very interesting. That's a big learning. Yeah. Okay. So
yeah, build the foundations of your
architecture. Yeah. Sorry. Early on. So we're getting a little bit of break up here, but that's okay. So there's probably someone sitting out there listening to this today who is thinking about starting their own business. What's the one bit of advice you'd give that person?
Are you talking about an e-commerce business or just a business?
Doesn't really matter. Just someone, you know, you've made the leap, you've made the big career change, you had a run at it and it's worked brilliantly. For someone who's in that position who's thinking, what advice would you give them?
I'd say do it and never look back. I'm helping my wife start a business right now, and just it's something in the side, and it's a really, really exciting change in your career. So every ounce of effort that you put into your own business, whether it's a flying success or it isn't, you know that you're doing for yourself, and it's such a rewarding enterprise. I would always think about doing things with minimum cost possible, and if it is an e-commerce business or if it's an internet business, I'd focus on getting the smallest amount of working solution out there in front of your audience as quickly as possible. So a minimum viable product. I just get the ball rolling as quickly as possible with minimal cost. And one of the lessons I've learned in running Secret Sales is don't get distracted by big spending competitors or new entrants in the market. Keep your head down, keep focused, do the best possible job you can do, because eventually things will turn in your favor. And that's exactly what happened to us. We kept our heads down. We had competitors that were spending loads of cash, making lots of noise, and they've failed in the market, and we're emerging with a much stronger business model. So I'd say anyone who's launching a business, don't get upset about the competitive landscape. Just keep focused.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today, Nish.
Sure, you're welcome. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover?
No, that's...